Jonathan Lethem's new novel, Chronic City, is the story of two unlikely friends. Chase Instedman, a former child actor who is now a harmless fixture on Manhattan's social scene, and Perkis Tooth, an underemployed pop critic and creator of pot-fueled conspiracy rants. The book is a blend of the real and the unreal, something of a virtual reality version of a city where even the fact-based, like a billionaire mayor and a perpetually delayed subway project, verge on the fantastic. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Jonathan Lethem back to our show today. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
As I read the names of your two main characters, I was reminded that almost all of the people in this novel have slightly skewed names. Una Laszlo, Laird Noteless, Richard Abneg, Georgine Hawkmanall, Sandra Saunders Epling. The sorts of names that we associate either with Restoration comedies or Thomas Pynchon novels.
Well, I guess, you know, I've always used unusual names, and the source of it is really simple for me. I, as a reader growing up, I loved memorable character names in Dickens or Pynchon or wherever I'd find them because I could remember them. And, you know, if a character was named Bill or Bob or Joe, I tended to forget. And so I was.
So Russian novels must have been a problem. Sergei Abramovich.
Yeah, I always had to write in the flap of my Russian novels to keep the characters straight. So I promised myself I'd give my readers the assistance, if not the pleasure, of memorable names, strange names.
And we do remember these names. Your best known novels have been set in Brooklyn, although your last one, You Don't Love Me Yet, was in Los Angeles. You grew up in Brooklyn, but you did live for a time in L.A.
Well, not in L.A., in the Bay Area. Yeah, I was a Californian for 10 years and got to know Los Angeles from afar. You know, the way – I mean, actually, the Bay Area attitude towards Los Angeles is not completely unlike a Brooklyn attitude towards Manhattan.
Oh, I would have said Boston.
Oh, well, Boston, and New York. There's that, too.
Have you spent much time in Manhattan's Upper East Side, which is what you write about here?
I grew up with some good friends there, and not on the glamorous, you know, the image of the Upper East Side derives from the Madison Avenue, Park Avenue side of things. And certainly there's this incredible citadel of, you know, money and power and museums. But there's the kind of invisible, scruffy Upper East Side of 1st and 2nd Avenue, and that's where I used to hang out.
In a previous interview, you said that the book's working title was Manhattan, although you must have known that that one was already taken by Woody Allen.
Yeah. I always have a bad title to begin with. It sits there for a while.
You said your intention was more Seinfeld-like, wasn't it?
I did. In a way, I wanted to see if I could write a book that would be, you know, like a novelization of Seinfeld as if by Gogol or Kafka. You know, what he would do with an endless situation comedy set among self-regarding Manhattanites.
And that show seemed to pretty much stick to the Upper West Side. This one's the Upper East Side. You don't leave the area at all here. It's as though there is no world outside.
Well, I guess part of my notion about Manhattan is that it's a bit of a virtual reality to begin with. It's kind of self-enclosed space. And it's true of certain neighborhoods and certain lives that I've known, you know, people I've known who create for themselves in Manhattan or elsewhere a kind of very limited sphere. The five or six places they go, you know, here's where I go for the bagel and here's where I go, you know, to the movies and then I go home and that's my city.
So could this just as easily have been set in Los Angeles, which is often described as a superficial city, or Williamsburg and Greenpoint, the new centers of art and artifice in our city?
I don't know. I for me, it feels intrinsically a Manhattan subject. And it's not strictly a satirical attack on Manhattan. There's something to me very glorious and poignant about the Manhattan attitude of self-involvement. I mean, I think that there's a way in which the city's idea of greatness and of its own importance can be a trap, but it's a very beautiful trap for people.
So do you see this book as or have you written this book as social commentary, something you've kind of avoided in the past?
I don't really think of it that way, no. If that happens, it sort of creeps in, but it's more a matter of looking at lives, characters and situations, moments in my own experience that I'm trying to find a way to embody on the page.
I guess the reason I ask is things like in your version of Manhattan, there's a war-free edition of the New York Times available. And since this thing takes place entirely in the Upper East Side, there's no evidence of a world outside of Manhattan. In the end, does a war matter much to its inhabitants?
Well, yeah, I was trying to write about matters of attention and inattention in daily life. That seemed to me to describe a lot of what I've gone through and what people I know have gone through in the last decade. And you know, everyone makes their own war-free edition of the New York Times. The moment you flip past those pages full of unbearable facts and photographs, you've done it. And so I'm just trying to exaggerate this, you know, this, I guess you'd call it, subjective system of making a tolerable reality that people undergo every day into something a little more obvious.
Well, not all of the characters are invented. You have Tina Brown, Salman Rushdie, Robert Smithson, Marlon Brando, Franz Kafka, Philip K. Dick, even my colleague Brian Lehrer here at WNYC.
He gets a line, actually.
Yeah.
I hope you're not too envious. But
well, it was appropriate. The situation was a Brian situation.
It was Lehrer-esque.
Yes, yeah. not a Lopez
situation. Not Lopezian, no. But, you know, most of those – I mean, I do drop names, I guess you'd say. Those people are sort of sighted in the distance. They're part of the scenery of Manhattan for the lives of my characters. But they're not really characters in the book. They're figures.
Well, Brian lives in Manhattan. I live in Brooklyn. I would assume that I'd be included in your next Brooklyn book.
I promise I'll put you in.
Jonathan Latham's latest novel is called Chronic City, and it is published by Doubleday. Wasn't Perkis Tooth the hero, although not the narrator of this book, also in one of your short stories, The Book of Other People? Did you feel you still had more to say about him?
That was a kind of dry run for the book, and most of that story is in the first chapter. It was really the opening shot, you know, meet Perkis Tooth. And I had a tremendous amount to say about him. He's a character that kind of bedevils me in a way. I'd been thinking about him or someone like him for a long time before I found the fictional means to put him across. You know, it's kind of the question of what is it to love someone, care for someone, completely impossible, you know, which is what the narrator ends up doing or feeling he's fated to do is take care of this person who won't be taken care of.
Well, your narrator isn't all that lovable either. But Perkis is skinny, moody, underemployed. He suffers from cluster headaches, has a serious case of the hiccups, a very serious case of the hiccups. Any one model for this? I know you used to work for the rock critic Paul Nelson, who lived on 84th Street, which is near where Perkis lives.
Yeah, well, I didn't really work for Paul. I kind of fell into his influence for a little while as a very young man, and he was a sort of spotlight onto culture for me. The things he was obsessed with became compelling to me, and so I did want to capture something of the feeling of what it was like to hang around with a kind of brilliant but fallen culture maven like Paul. But then on the other hand, there are so many things about Perkis Tooth that don't resemble Paul at all. Paul would never have touched drugs, and he wasn't a dandy. He sort of walked around in an old cloth cap all the time. So he's a combination of a number of ideas and images, and there's part of myself in him.
Did he have one of the few remaining rent-controlled apartments that dot the Upper East Side?
He was.
Perkis lives in one of those.
Yeah, Paul was, towards the end of his life, in some ways almost a prisoner of his illegal sublet, and you know, as can happen in Manhattan, people's lives become entrenched in their real estate decisions, or you know, the unwillingness to let go of a good deal becomes a kind of weird fate.
And real estate plays a major role in this story.
Yeah, well, I think it plays a major role in the life of the city, and so I wanted to again exaggerate that into visibility wherever I could. Many of the characters are sort of obsessed with their apartments.
Well, talk about obsession. Perkis is a conspiracy theorist, if there ever was one. Although he denies it, he sees plots everywhere. In the typeface of the New Yorker, in an old VHS copy of Dead Man Don't Wear Plaid.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the flip side of what I mentioned earlier, the idea of inattention, that to make our days tolerable, we have to blank out a lot of stuff, edit everything, or become amnesiac. Well, the other side is we're all sort of trying to make sense of the intricate chaos of you know, getting through your days of everyday life. And so pattern making, searching for the meaningful clues is something we're all stuck with. In Perkis's case, it's run riot.
Well, there were any number of rock fans who did this sort of thing to their favorite music. But Perkis hates being called a rock critic. Why?
I guess I was fooling around with ideas of kind of a caste system in cultural life, that there are shameful cultural identities, you know, science fiction writer or soap opera fan or rock critic, that are kind of seen as subcasts of an important activity, and therefore they're full of this kind of complicated shame, but also defiance. People who take on these identities become very, you know, willful and proud of them.
So that obviously refers to your situation, where at different times in your life you have been described as a sci-fi writer or as a writer of detective fiction, genres that aren't high literary.
I guess that's right. But more than that, I grew up in a bohemian family, and I sort of identified with marginality all along. I always felt that the action was sort of on these excluded edges. But I inherited also that kind of, you know, defiant, self-loathing energy that comes with being on the margins.
What should I read into the narrator's name, Chase Insteadman?
Oh,
instead of what?
Yeah. Instead of what is the question? I guess I'd wish you to frame. It's again this question of feeling that the primary matter of life has gone elsewhere. That your face is pressed to the window, looking in at what really matters, but you can't get there. And I think Chase is haunted by the sense that his important life was over before he had any hand in it. He was a child star, and now everyone thinks of him as a sort of faintly glamorous has-been.
Or the loyal support. I don't want to go into all the plot details.
There's a lot of plot details.
He has and a lot of plot surprises. He has a girlfriend who has been stranded and is ill in outer space.
Yeah. He's been given one of these very simple roles that our media likes to assign. You know, he's the grieving fiancé, and he doesn't understand why he doesn't feel his role more authentically. It seems like it ought to be enough, but he can't quite invest himself in it.
Well, in an interview you gave to Wall Street Journal, you spoke of trying to figure out what your job was.
Yeah, I think, you know, being a novelist is a situation that consists of being befuddled a lot of the time, trying to take on roles. You know, you're a bit of a character actor. You're trying to – or a method actor, I should say. You're trying to feel your way into other lives. And I suppose I identified with Chase as an actor in that sense. I was thinking about the weird mercurial haplessness that comes over you when you're supposed to play parts.
Well, he is far from an omniscient narrator. He's called to dupe by other characters.
And
that was that important to not have a narrator who knows everything that's going on?
I've always thought that the best way to deal with complicated stuff in a novel is to have the narrator as helpless as the reader will inevitably be. When I wrote about particle physics in a book called As She Climbed Across the Table, which is something that I barely understand myself or glancingly have ever understood, I made my character a humanities professor on the campus where the particle physics was being conducted, so that he could be a reader surrogate for thinking, not only I don't understand this stuff, but am I really going to be asked to? Do I have to think about that? And Chase has that kind of position in this book.
Weather is almost gothic in this novel.
I like that description. Weather is almost gothic. I would just put it.
Well, there's a gray cloud that settles over the financial district.
Yeah.
And I guess we can read something into that metaphor. But also, it snows in July. And you've said that this is kind of like one of those what are those things called? The where you just turn them over and it snows all
the time? A snow globe, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to catch with this book, if I could, the creeping banality and omniscience of disaster. You know, things like global warming or war are sort of always present and nowhere at all. They're like the weather. They sort of just hang over us, and we can't stop thinking about them, and we can't stop trying not to have to think about them. They're just sort of stuck in the middle distance. And so I guess the weather kind of embodied that for me.
Well, you mentioned Dickens earlier, and there is a sense, this atmosphere. In Dickens' case, it was the result of the Industrial Revolution,
right. Yeah.
Making London really sooty and unlivable. But the atmosphere here is kind of oppressive. Reference to Dickens?
Well, I thought about Dickens a lot, just trying to do anything panoramic in a city like this book attempts, inevitably, you know, brings him to mind. And I was thinking about the opening in the river of our mutual friend, trying to capture that heavy feeling of the city being with you at all times.
Yeah, this is one of a number of books you've written that kind of blends the real with the surreal. What is it about that approach that appeals to you so much?
Well, what can I say? I do it out of love. It's I'm embracing the modes in fiction that matter most to me, and I want to have it both ways. I don't know whether it is possible, but I seem to be fated to try to make it possible in my work.
And as I said earlier, in some cases the real seems unreal, like Mayor Arnheim, who everybody will read Mayor Bloomberg into.
Yeah, but
although
I think
he's a villain here.
I pulled
for some people, I guess Bloomberg is a villain too.
Yeah, I think I drew together in my mind. I drew characteristics from the previous administration into this image as well. I mean, the sort of lifestyle police that go around in black vans, keeping people from smoking marijuana on the street and so on. But yes, I find Bloomberg a conundrum. He's so seductive, and yet he's built of money, which in a way I just fundamentally distrust money, and this book is distrustful of money.
Well, you must know that this kind of book is going to please some people a lot. One of the reviewers called it a masterpiece. Michiko Kakutani was less kind.
Other than a masterpiece.
So it's obvious that there are some people who will respond to this kind of writing and others who won't.
Yeah, I tend to feel that the more I become the writer I am, the more fully I manifest the stuff I want to do, the more divisive it's going to be.
Jonathan Lethem will be in conversation with Colson Whitehead on Friday at 9:30 at the Directors Guild Theater as part of the New Yorker Festival. He'll be reading and signing books next Tuesday at Book Court at 163 Court Street.